On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
We'll start, as we always do, with a quick tour of what's making the front pages of this morning's newspapers. The Sunday Independent tells us that the offices of the online gambling firm started by the former billionaire Sean Quinn and his family have been searched by Gardaí as part of an investigation. Sean Quinn's son-in-law, Stephen Kelly, who is the managing director of QuinnBet, says he doesn't know why the offices were searched, but that he's confident that the online gambling business is not the target of the Gardaí inquiry. The Gardaí themselves are also confirming that they have searched a number of commercial premises, but they don't discuss the identity of the commercial premises, and they haven't explained exactly why they were searching those premises. But we also learn on the front page of the Sunday Independent via Hugh O'Connell, who's with us, and we'll talk to him in just a few minutes' time, that the number of spectators allowed to attend sporting events will increase next month by up to 50% of the capacity of stadiums. And that's despite the controversy over the 40,000 people who attended last week's All-Ireland Hurling Final. This would mean the end to the current rules, which only allow 200 to 500 people to attend most sports events other than those which are designated pilots, which are, I suppose, is good news for the forthcoming GAA club championships, but also might be good news for other League of Ireland clubs as well, who have been struggling along with fairly limited attendances for the last couple of months. Also on the front page, briefly, of the Sunday Independent this morning, some deep concern for around 60 citizens and their families who remain trapped in Afghanistan as Irish diplomats continue to help them find a way of getting back to Ireland. It would seem like the European and American forces that are still on the ground are fully intent on evacuating Hamid Karzai Airport in Kabul by Tuesday, which leaves very few opportunities for those remaining Irish people, and indeed some Afghan nationals who are Irish residents, to be able to get out before effectively the airport becomes Taliban property once again. The front page of the Business Post: COVID rules and regulations to give way to an era of personal responsibility. We're told that Ireland will move away from the series of rules and restrictions following the final winding down of COVID-19 restrictive measures through September and October. Speaking to the Business Post, Michael McGrath, the Minister for Public Expenditure, who is one of the members of the Cabinet Subcommittee which met on Friday, said that the Irish public had done everything that was asked of them and the time had come to effectively unwind all of the social restrictions put in place to manage the pandemic. He says what we're looking at is a shift away from a system based on rules and restrictions to a system based on personal responsibility and living cautiously alongside the virus. And that will involve the unwinding of the vast majority of the more stringent restrictions over the coming months. If you didn't hear it, the Taoiseach was speaking to reporters on Friday evening, and he was asked if he expects the provisions of the roadmap for relaxed restrictions, would that likely continue into November? And he answered no. And then when he was asked if that meant that all the restrictions would be stood down in September and October, did the usual thing of saying, well, nothing's been signed off on and I don't want to prejudge next Tuesday's cabinet. But he did say no when asked if it was going to go on until November, which effectively means that pretty much all the major restrictions are going to be stood down in the next 2 months. Also a fascinating story on the front page of the Business Post, and we'll have Eoin O'Brien with us in the second hour, and we will discuss this with him. Large institutional investors have started to lease back former social housing properties originally built by the state back to the state for use as social housing under the lengthy lease arrangements. The Business Post has learned that second-hand homes in old council estates are now being rented back to South Dublin County Council at an estimated rent of around €1,500 a month, with no option for purchase at the end of the 25-year lease. These were homes which were originally built by the state, would have been sold to their tenants at a cut price of between 40 to 60% of market value sometime between the 1980s and 1990s. In the meantime, they've been bought by funds, and those funds are now leasing back the properties that the state itself built back to the state. And in some cases, those homes were repossessed by investment funds after the financial crash, when those who had bought the properties from the councils weren't able to make their loan repayments. So it would seem like a pretty clear edifice of dysfunction in the market if the state is now renting back some of its own 50, 60, 70 year old houses as social housing and then won't actually own them at the end when the time might come to replace them. The Sunday Times also tells us about the forthcoming changes to COVID restrictions, but we are told that it's not exactly going to be a full Freedom Day the way that England had it, because face masks will probably remain mandatory in public transport, in shops and in hospitals at least until next spring. Or at least that's the advice from Tony Houlihan. He says that personal judgment will play an increasing role in whether to wear face coverings elsewhere if COVID restrictions or COVID infection rates rather do continue to fall throughout the autumn. His advice on behalf of NPHET was shared with ministers at that cabinet committee on Friday before they adjourned to allow officials draw up a timetable for the lifting of some of those restrictions. We also learn in that piece that Catherine Martin is expected to press the case for the entertainment sector to reopen from September the 6th, which is when the COVID committee is likely to meet again tomorrow, and she will make that case. But the expectation is that the entertainment industry may not be allowed to return until later in the month. And we also learn on the front page of the Sunday Times that the Dáil is actually going back to Leinster House, that it will be limited restrictions or limited attendances, but that the Dáil will no longer be sitting in the National Convention Centre, a venue which has cost about €2.2 million for its use in all the time that the Dáil has been there. They will be back in Leinster House, albeit with restricted numbers. And very finally for now, the front page of the Mail on Sunday. Green TD is silent, says the headline, as female rivals abused by text. We're told that a prominent Green Party TD and an Oireachtas Committee chairman has been embroiled in a row over a sickening series of slurs against women. This is Brian Leddon, who's the chairman of the Oireachtas Environment and Climate Action Committee, who apologised last night for some comments he made in a WhatsApp group that he himself set up in 2017. And if you read further down the page, which has just managed to skip in front of me, we're told that other comments made by members of the Policy Focus Group, which included figures with prominent positions in Limerick, repeatedly referred to women viewed as rivals with misogynistic abuse. We're told last night that Brian Leddon had said that one other councillor was unhinged and that they describe fame. He didn't intervene when other people used some more fairly derogatory language, which I won't repeat at this hour of the day. Brian Leddon admits he was a member of the private WhatsApp group. He says it was made up of a small number of men and women interested in planning and heritage issues in Limerick City. He acknowledged that some of the language used by members was unsavoury and inappropriate, and while he didn't encourage such comments or engage with them, on reflection he should have intervened to voice his unhappiness with such language. That's the front page of this morning's Irish Mail on Sunday. As I said, Hugh O'Connell of the Irish and Sunday Independent is with us. We're also joined by Ilona Duffy, a GP based in Monaghan, medical director of the North East Doctor on Call Service. Good morning to you both, Hugh. I will start with yourself, just because you've got that story on the sidebar of the front page of the Sunday Independent. The go-ahead for bigger crowds at matches, which I suppose comes hand-in-hand with the idea that maybe within 2 months there won't be an effort anymore.
Yeah, it's a shift in policy from the current restrictions allow 200 people at outdoor gatherings and 500 in the case where a venue is 5,000 capacity or more, with exceptions for certain designated pilot events, and we've had a number of those. We had one yesterday at Croke Park. We had one last Sunday at Croke Park, caused a bit of controversy.
I mean, it's sort of ironic that we would consider long-standing affairs like the All-Ireland Senior Championships to be events. It's not like they're experimental.
Well, they are for public in terms of public health, I guess, in terms of allowing the tens of thousands of people to attend as did yesterday and last Sunday. But we're now moving, or the intention is to move to a kind of a percentage model as opposed to these numbers, specified numbers with some exceptions for pilot events. So that could see up to 50% of a venue being full with spectators. So that would put 25,000 people in the Aviva thereabouts, 40,000 in Croke Park thereabouts. That is the hope and the intention. It might not be up to 50% at the beginning, or 50% at the beginning rather, but certainly the intention is that it would be over 25%. And obviously then, in terms of outdoor arts and culture venues, potentially you're getting those kind of percentages in that place as well. So really, it's about getting more people into these places now that we've reached such a high degree of vaccination, that the government believes that now is the time to start unwinding the last remaining COVID-19 restrictions while keeping in place. And I think Michael McGrath alludes to this in the Sunday Business Post today. This kind of, I suppose, imploring the public to exercise personal responsibility, to avoid crowded situations where they feel it might be a bit risky, to wear their masks, to continue to practice good hand hygiene, and all of these things that we were encouraged to do at the start of the pandemic before we started implementing the sorts of restrictions that we've had to live with for the last 18 months.
I'm just to get a little bit of deja vu with the talk about being told to avoid crowds, because I suppose inferred in that is the idea that crowds will exist and that in some circumstances the state isn't going to stop them existing, and that sounds like some of the false dawns that we've maybe had before.
The difference is vaccination. I mean, true. Vaccination provides a high degree of protection, and Ilona knows this better than I do, but it prevents a lot of serious illness and death. It doesn't prevent all serious illness and death, but it certainly prevents a lot of it.
On those outdoor gatherings and the likes of sports events, we know that the Taoiseach has basically all but confirmed that these measures are going to be rolled out across September and October. Do we know, it might be going to be a case that from as early as Monday week the 6th that we could begin to start having some of those larger crowds, or is it likely to be pushed back towards the end of the month?
A lot of people in government are talking about the middle of the month, kind of from 13th of September onwards, certainly in terms of things like return to the office. That will be done on a kind of a phased basis. Employers will be urged to you know, allow some employees to come back to the office. It won't be necessarily prescriptive. There'll be a large degree of autonomy. And of course, the way people are working has changed radically over the last 18 months. The reality is an awful lot of workers will never go back to the office because they have arrangements in place that suit them better in terms of working from home or working in remote working hubs. So mid-September is kind of the point at which I think you're going to see a lot of these sort of measures being talked about across the papers today coming into effect. Initially, I think from next week, you're going to see public transport return to 100% capacity. Schools obviously are going back and colleges as well. So really, the government wants to see what is the impact of that in terms of the disease trajectory. Okay. I know Philip Nolan, the NPHET head of modelling, has said that they expect an increase in cases as a result of schools going back, but that it would be possibly transient, so that it might peak a little bit and then drop off again. That's the hope, that's the expectation. And then you're getting into the middle and late September and then early October when the rest of the kind of stuff that's been talked about in the papers today is going to be implemented.
Ilona, there's plenty that I could ask you for your reaction on in the papers, and I suppose I will, but just because you're based in Monaghan, which is one of the counties that still has the highest incidence rate, how has life been for you dealing with things in the last couple of weeks? Is it as busy as it ever was, busier? Is it less busy? Are people getting sick but less sick? Or just how has it been?
I suppose it surged again in the last couple of weeks because we're definitely seeing a rise in positive cases and managing those. The majority of the cases are young people. In fact, quite a lot of young children. They're not particularly sick, but they are symptomatic. They're symptomatic with similar type viral symptoms that they would have normally at this time of the year. But we're now finding that they're COVID positive. And I suppose of concern is we are then seeing that transmit to older members who are vaccinated. So family members like grandparents, parents, none of whom have been particularly sick, but they still have the potential then to transmit it on to others again. Mm. And obviously we know that there will be those who have underlying health conditions, who are immunocompromised, who are likely not to have the protection that we'd want from the vaccine and therefore end up sicker. And obviously there's still quite a significant cohort it's probably larger that I'm finding more with patients contacting us who were doing a bit of contact tracing on them, who are saying, well, no, I didn't get vaccinated. And this tends to be people in their 20s and 30s. And some of those are parents. So kids are bringing it home from creches, infecting them and then passing on. So
parents, okay. It
is busy again. And I suppose schools are going back, as we've already said. Mm. And definitely we're going to see a surge in cases. We've seen that in Scotland. They're already back at school. Yeah. And within a fortnight, the numbers rose quite dramatically. But I think the big thing is, if, as you said, Hugh, if we can see this as a transient thing, if we know that the rest of the adult population is vaccinated, the majority of those, if they meet the vaccine, either won't become infected or become infected with low enough viral levels that they're not going to transmit it on further and further. Mm. So we may see that peak over a 2 to 3 week period and then hopefully see it dampen down. That's presuming we continue to have the majority of our adults vaccinated.
I will talk in more detail maybe later in the hour about schools and particularly what's maybe going to happen when schools come back and whether they themselves are safe. But I suppose in light of all of that and what you're describing there with, you know, being busier in the last couple of weeks, not necessarily people very sick, but people who are sick nonetheless. How do you feel with that sort of horizon about the idea of the government deciding that there's no longer a place for NPHET inside the next 2 months or so?
I kind of think we're not out of the woods yet, and I'm surprised to think that NPHET might be closing down so soon. You'd like to feel that it was there at least until the end of the year to just monitor, track and advise, because that's really what we want from them. They're the ones who have the knowledge, they have the expertise, and I think we'll still need them. I think moving forward, things like the return to work, I think we need stronger guidance on that and stronger advice. And I think we need to be taking a bigger stand on that with regards to those who are vaccinated and unvaccinated, because there will be lots of areas where offices and businesses will need people back in the workplace and where actually workers want to go back in. How are we going to handle that? And I think we need definitive guidance on that. Can people be in the same office? Should they be segregated? Should they be moved to other areas? We know that's what's happening in the HSE. If you're not vaccinated, you're moved to a non-face-to-face role with patients, but that's to protect you and to protect others you're working with as well as patients. So should we be looking at something like that in our office spaces? We know that other countries like the US are doing that and many big businesses are, but there seems to be a reluctance here on us to bias against anyone who's not vaccinated. And I think that's not fair on those who are.
Hugh, I suppose one interesting issue that's raised by that, and we were discussing this outside as well, and we discussed, you know, that the do politicians now have less cover because NPHET won't be there as the big bad bogeyman in the corner of the room being seen to direct all these things. But I suppose if public health advice is still going to exist anyway, and if you might still have the cabinet subcommittee that Philip Nolan and Tony Houlihan and others might be attending anyway, then then I suppose you can make the question, what is the point of disbanding NPHET if there's still going to need to be some public health input in decisions the government's making?
I suppose, though, it's reflective of the change that's happened, I think, over the last couple of months, which, I mean, NPHET met this week for the first time in a month. And in that time, Tony Hulihan and Philip Nolan and Ronan Glynn were into the cabinet subcommittee briefing them on the latest trajectory of the disease, the so-called epidemiological situation. Yeah. So that advice was still being provided, notwithstanding the fact that NPHET hadn't met. So winding down NPHET, I suppose, is reflective of the fact that its influence as a structure is sort of waned somewhat, and that the cabinet subcommittee has become sort of the preeminent body for decision making, because they take input from the HSC, make presentations, the vaccine task force make presentations, and Tony Hulihan and Philip Nolan make presentations as well, and there's lots of graphs and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, that it seems to be where the politicians get their advice from, rather than waiting for the NPHET letter per se.
Yeah.
So I think that it's just really reflective of the fact that NPHET has changed in a way that now it's really more about what Tony and Philip and Paul Reid, the HSE chief executive, say.
But is there an element of like trying to push a government goodwill and get that, you know, get this bounce back there? We're getting rid of NPHET. Things are moving ahead. We're opening up.
I think that's true.
But the chair of NPHET is still going to be sitting in all these discussions anyway.
But I think it's dangerous as well. Like we've just talked there about, you know, the football and the GAA games going ahead with the likes of 40,000 people gathering. It wasn't even necessarily by being in at the match. Mm. It was the aftermath. We all saw the photographs of people congregating, and there are thousands and thousands, nobody with masks, and yet smaller things aren't allowed to open up. Like, we still haven't opened up anything to do with the arts and entertainment business.
Or bowling alleys, indoor play centres for kids.
It's big for the government. They get bang for their buck, a bigger bang for their buck, by saying, yes, we're letting the GAA large matches back, so they get that goodwill. We're opening up, we're going against the baddies and NPHET, we're closing them down. So you have to just think, what is this all about?
Out of interest, and I'd be interested to get your kind of first-hand take on this, just because you mentioned the All-Irelands and some of the controversy there was around that, and it might still be a couple of days before we know whether there is any surge in infections for the people of Cork and Limerick and maybe Dublin as a result of the crowds that gathered. There were 18,000 fans from Tyrone and Monaghan in Croke Park 4 weeks ago for the Ulster final. Obviously, you're a GP in Monaghan. Anecdotally, and I know it can only be anecdotally, did you think that you found any increase in case numbers arising from that specifically?
I can't say not specifically. I think, as you say, the big test will be in the next week to 2 weeks. Are we going to see a rise in figures? Because again, we know, I listened to Dr. Black from the BMA in the north talking about the low vaccination rates in the Tyrone area, and that obviously they've got very high figures, positivity rates. So I think there can only be one impact of this, and we're going to see rates. Whether we're going to see the high rises in the south or whether it'll be limited just in Tyrone, we'll just have to wait and see.
Liam has already been in touch on Twitter. He says that the vast majority of the public will be glad to see the back of NPHET. They were created for a purpose, and that purpose has now lessened hugely. They as individuals have important roles to return to, and we do owe them our thanks, but he believes that they are no longer necessary. Do get in touch. The hashtag is on the record NT. I suppose, Hugh, there might also be a question of, if NPHET were to be removed as a standalone structure, even if there is still influence, then will there still be as much weight, or will people still think that there is as much gravitas to requests like the one that we see on the front page of the Sunday Times today, that you still will be asked to wear a mask in some settings?
Yeah, well, that's a fair point, and I think Ilona makes a fair point as well. By standing down the National Public Health Emergency Team, are you effectively saying that the public health emergency is over? And of course, it most definitely isn't. I mean, I think even politically, ministers would admit that we do have to get through another winter to see how, and then, you know, there's the impact of potential waning immunity from vaccines, the booster program that they're talking about implementing over the course of the winter. So we really do have to kind of get through that, I think, before we can say that, well, definitively, or we may never be able to say definitively, the public health emergency itself is over. So, you know, there will be plenty of people, I think, who will question the decision to stand down NPHET and whether that goes ahead or not in October, as is being suggested. And it does raise the point as to what extent will Tony Hulihan be listened to now, that he doesn't have that public health emergency structure in place within the Department of Health to back him up, you know. There are 40 odd people, I think, who sit on NPHET, all of varying expertise from all different strands of the health of the health service, from the front line to the back end, and all of them going back to their day jobs and not meeting on a on a weekly or a monthly basis, mm. it does lose you a certain degree.
And the importance of public health, I think, has really been shown throughout this.
Correct,
that public health, nobody really knew what a public health doctor was,
or didn't understand
anywhere.
The discipline of it.
Or was underfunded. Yeah.
And now we realise that they're a pivotal part of the healthcare system, and we're under-resourced and understaffed for so long.
Mm. Maybe I'm just a little bit cynical, but I think it's curious that this idea of abolishing NPHET, which would also, by the way, mean abolishing Tony Houlihan's standalone press conferences outside of a government umbrella, comes only a couple of days after he suggested that the All-Ireland should be the preserve of the vaccinated only, but that electric picnic could go ahead as long as it's the vaccinated only, and all of the political clamour that that's caused in the last 3 or 4 days because he was given a forum to speak more freely than other civil servants get to do. Maybe I'm just a little bit cynical.
Well, I mean, I think that tension has existed all the way through the pandemic. I mean, I don't think anyone in government was particularly happy about his tweet about the scenes on South William Street, because this was a kind of an intervention from nowhere. Mm. Similarly, we saw what happened last October. When he came back from annual leave, and or not sorry not from annual leave from an extended leave to care for his wife,
and then proposed level 5,
proposed moving from level 2 to level 5, which really upset the political system, and had knock on consequences. So there has been that tension, I think, since particularly in the last year, I would say, between Tony Houlihan as a very prominent civil servant, probably one of the most prominent civil servants we've had in the history of the state, certainly one of the most powerful. And the impact he's had, both, I suppose, in terms of what we've all been through over the last 18 months.
We've just touched upon it there, but we do want to have a slightly longer discussion about one variable that we've never dealt with before, and that's sending schools back while Delta is in circulation. We were about to talk about the return to schools, but we were just chatting there during the break, and you were just happened to express some concern around contact tracing. And we, you know, those of us like myself and Hugh who cover politics through the kind of the official sphere, the official word has always been that we now have finally built up contact tracing to 800 full-time staff. There was never any suggestion of that being wound down, and that they thought would be enough to deal with any further surges that were coming along. You obviously have a little bit more frontline experience, and you're not quite so sure that's the case.
Well, we always knew that when positive levels and positive cases reached a certain level, that contact tracing became under strain, and that they would often go to a kind of a rapid type contact tracing, which wasn't as in-depth as perhaps would be when the numbers were lower. Now, that seems nonsensical in many ways, because you'd be thinking, actually, the higher the numbers, the more in-depth the contact tracing needs to be.
But there's always finite capacity and finite hours, and the more people there are, the less you can do with each of them.
But we were always being told that there was going to be a way of upping that. So we know that when the contact tracing started, there were a huge number of people who were redeployed from other kind of healthcare type settings or teaching roles in healthcare settings. So I remember being contact traced myself by a lecturer of nursing. So that was kind of happening. And there were a lot of people who maybe students and things who weren't at college who were in those roles and trained up and doing it for a long time. But we are aware that many of those have been redeployed or have gone back to their other roles. So there've had to be kind of a new intake of contact tracers, some of whom obviously are going to take quite a bit of time before they become as experienced. But my own experience with regards to patients recently has been that the contact tracing has definitely been less intense and not as good. I mean, I have one story of a patient who tested positive and was very symptomatic. So I knew high viral load, therefore going to be spreading it. Has two children about to go back to boarding school. And when he tried to talk to the contact tracer about that, basically, it was shut down and said, no, well, the most important thing is that you stay home for 10 days. And, you know, nobody wants to know and tell him, no, definitely those kids cannot go back to boarding school. Otherwise, you're going to have an absolute spread amongst groups. So I think the contact tracing is something that we think it's working and it should be working. And we know it's the vital component of containing cases, especially now that we're talking about going back to schools. And I think one of the articles that's in the paper today does talk about the concerns that teachers had and principals had about the slow contact tracing that happened with regards to outbreaks in schools. And we know that many of the schools were having to do their own contact tracing. In fact, I have two creches had to do their own contact tracing, contact the parents with regards to positive kids in the creches, because the contact tracing was so slow. It was like 5 days later before they were being contacted. So that's not going to be good enough if we're going back to schools. No. We have to ensure that actually priority contact tracing will be there to give advice to the schools, give advice to those kids and their parents, and tease out, are those parents vaccinated? How likely is it that we're going to see that further spread out into the community?
That kind of nicely brings us to the topic of the reopening of schools, and I'll come to that in just a second. But Hugh, just for thoughts on that, because like I said, that we were always, you know, at an official level, we were sort of told that there was never going to be any threat to capacity. Maybe it's fair enough that some there's turnover of workers in contact tracing, that some leave and others are brought in. But the idea that they might be actively doing less work at a time when surely more is required is really unsettling, isn't
it? It's concerning. It's certainly not what we understood the contact tracing system to be. I mean, it was scaled up massively towards the back end of last year, and then, you know, obviously went through a very difficult time over the winter. But the idea was that it was scaled up permanently and it was there when was necessary. And of course, you know, we are detecting an awful lot of cases at the moment, that, you know, just about 1,800 to 2,000 per day. So you would have thought that there would be a contact tracing system that would reflect that, and the fact that, okay, contact tracing has changed a little bit now in terms of, if you're a close contact, you don't necessarily have to isolate for 10 days if you're vaccinated. But certainly it wasn't, you know, I'm surprised to hear that. I'm surprised that that's becoming an issue.
And one other little thing that's also changed, I suppose, GPs provided a certain amount of backup to that contact tracing, and that when we got the results, we would ring the person and kind of talk to them a little bit about it. So we'd definitely be able to advise them on any of the household contacts and perhaps make it easier for those people to remain at home by saying, well, look, we can provide you with the social welfare cert so that you can stay home if you're not able to work from home. But now, because so many people are able to walk into the test centres and get tested, which is fantastic, and definitely we're seeing many people going with minimal symptoms to get tested, we don't get those results. We're only getting the results of the people who we refer for testing. And again,
if you're kind of a frontline social safety net where you refer people to the welfare benefits and everything else, that there isn't necessarily the same kind of follow through for individual cases, and that is problems too.
I suppose when contact tracing ran into difficulty, there was always the knowledge that at least the GPs were going to be ringing the positive cases and offering them advice and saying, hey, you need to ring X, Y, and Z, tell them this is the advice you give them. And that's, you know, do we want to, I suppose, look at, am I looking for more work for GPs? Not necessarily.
But I suppose it's the loss of the personal touch, though, when you have like massive testing centres that you don't have someone with whom they have a long-standing relationship who can call them and say, listen, you need to stay at home. Your kids aren't supposed to go to boarding school.
And might recognise our number. See, that's the other thing. We know that contact tracing, part of the slowness is trying to get through to people. They don't answer their phone. They don't recognise the number. They can't ring back. They're told, keep your phone free. We'll phone you again. But, you know, people put down their phone. They're not, we'd hope everybody isn't tied to their phone. So look, it's something we may have to rethink, especially as the schools reopen, that GPs perhaps would take on that role again.
Yeah, now there may be no link at all between the idea of maybe contact tracing not being as strong as it previously was and the forthcoming return to schools, and indeed the fact that, of course, we're already at the tail end of August, so some people have already gone back to schools, but we'll have the full return this coming week, and then universities and colleges in a couple of weeks' time as well. This will obviously be the first time that we've reopened schools while Delta was a thing. And up until now, although we've dealt with schools under the Alpha variant for a few months, that we don't know what schooling is going to be like with Delta on our shores. Is there any reason to think that the school environment and maybe this idea of a transient short-term bump and then going away again, or is there basically any way, alone, I suppose, of saying that schools will be any different this time, or that they'll be any more or less safe than they previously were?
Well, we know from data in the UK, and we knew this some period of time ago, that the Delta variant did seem to be spreading faster among the younger, so really the teenagers and younger. And that was very different to previous variants that seemed to kind of hit the adults and older people. Is that because maybe we're testing them more aggressively? Perhaps, but definitely, I suppose, symptomatically, when people are ringing us about their children with symptoms, in the past, we were testing them kind of fully confident they probably wouldn't be positive. Now we're fully confident that they will be positive. So we've definitely seen a change in how this virus is hitting people. And I think Dennis McCauley from the IMO kind of described it as, this virus is looking for the unvaccinated. And okay, it can't theoretically do that, but it definitely is spreading amongst them. So we're going back to a school environment. It's going to be, you know, they're talking about the CO2 monitors to kind of highlight things in the classroom. Is there enough ventilation? Already in the schools last year, windows were open. I know my own poor kids sat freezing last winter in their jumpers and not necessarily allowed to wear coats and things. So is that going to happen? I think a lot of the 16 plus will be vaccinated. There's a huge push amongst them. They want to be vaccinated because they want to meet. They want to be able to think that they'll go to concerts.
But they're on
things.
The same school corridors as 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 year olds.
They are.
So it's not ideal.
I think the reality is we will see a surge now. Totally. We're going to see a surge. But as long as that is limited to children who are likely not to become unwell, and as long as we know that those children, well, I suppose it's really only from 12 up who are high risk, have had the chance to get the vaccine. And I think most parents who have a child with medical difficulties and medical needs that leave them more vulnerable will have grabbed this vaccine with both hands. And we can only hope that they will therefore be protected. But we've still, back to what we talked about earlier, there's got to be strong contact tracing. And we've also got some strong responsibility from parents that if you have a child, no matter how mild the symptoms are, that you arrange for them to be tested and you're not sending them into school.
Hugh, your colleague Wayne O'Connor is writing in the Sun Independent today that the headline of the piece is that teachers see the HSE's role as crucial, but I suspect what I'm hearing from Alona is that the HSE probably sees teachers' roles as being equally crucial in trying to stop another wave arising from all of this.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think everyone will be expected to play their part in sort of ensuring that schools are as safe as possible. Schools are as safe as possible, and includes teachers, and includes that the, you know, the contact tracing is up to scratch. I suppose one of the statistics I saw last week that stood out for me, I think, is that 51% of 12 to 15 year olds have registered for the vaccine at this stage. I mean, that certainly needs to increase over the coming weeks, in order to get to a point where you build it up to what it is in the general population. I think everyone's expecting a surge, certainly.
Well, we had Neva Byrne, the HSE's lead for testing and tracing, with us last week, and she said that they fully expect there to be another surge or a peak.
So the question then is, what impact,
2 weeks of September?
What overall impact does it have? I mean, the crucial thing is to what extent is there then breakthrough infections among the vaccinated population? To what extent does it put pressure on hospital admissions, ICU admissions? And then, you know, to what extent does it, or to how long does it last? Does it last a couple of weeks, and does it then start to trail off again? I mean, we see in Scotland what's happening, which is extraordinary. If you look at the graphs, they almost go in a vertical line, straight up, in terms of the surge in cases. I think 6,800 reported last Friday, which is a new record.
For context, Scotland goes back to school earlier than we do.
So they've already had the back to school surge, I suppose. But there, you know, there's some context around that, which is that the vaccination rate in Scotland is a good degree lower than it is here. I think it's just north of 70%, whereas here we are kind of north of 80%, north of 85%. So, I mean, that's a big difference when you think about it. And I think that will hopefully avoid the kind of situation that they have in Scotland now. I mean, you know, it was ironic. Yeah. Nicola Sturgeon was talking about on Friday, the First Minister of Scotland's talking about the idea of introducing a vaccine pass for indoor activities. And of course, we've had that, and we're talking about phasing it out now in October. And I suppose that is testament to the approach in Ireland being slightly more cautious, slightly more steady, and has allowed more people to be vaccinated and perhaps given us that extra layer of protection. But we'll see.
Well, I'm again reminded that we thought that we had bought ourselves, that we were the first country to go into a second lockdown last autumn, and we thought that we'd done it early and that we'd nipped it off. And look what happened then at Christmas when we thought that we'd bought ourselves.
Yeah, but the different factors. Government made certain decisions there, probably the incorrect ones. The alpha wave, the alpha variant. Mm-hmm. Had a massive impact there, and we had no vaccination.
And they ignored Neffet. Neffet didn't say, "I told you."
Well,
so.
Neffet presented a choice, and the government chose both things.
Which they give strong guidance, so if we don't get the numbers below a certain figure, it will be impacting on us in the new year.
Leads us to a tweet from Eamon, who says, "Who are the government going to blame when Neffet are gone?" Which I think is a very sage question. Briefly, Alona, because we've been talking about the idea of mostly unvaccinated children going back into the same environments, but we are also likely to see, and there's mention of it in Hugh's own piece in the Sunday Independent and in other papers, about the return to work, which would mean mostly vaccinated but some unvaccinated adults going back into enclosed and not always brilliantly ventilated spaces either. You have some concerns about how exactly that's going to be handled.
Well, I think there's an article in the Sunday Independent and by Niamh Horan, and talked about just the return of the unjabbed, the minefield for Irish CEOs. And I think it's a minefield for anyone who's an employer. It's really difficult. The HSE are already dealing with this with regards to people who would have face-to-face patient contact. So if you're unvaccinated, you will be redeployed, and you'll be redeployed to another area, and that may have different hours, different terms, all of the rest. So I think there's been a reluctance here for us to kind of support businesses with regards to how they're going to handle this, because, okay, there's the right not to have the vaccination, but if you're unvaccinated, you pose a risk to everybody else that you're going to be with. And while your family may choose that, your co-workers may not choose that. So how are employees to handle this? Are they going to have separate rooms for the unvaccinated and the vaccinated?
Especially if the unvaccinated co-worker has a child of school age.
Exactly. And I really think, I suppose I'd be asking Neffet really to make some stronger guidance on this. And I think it's so important. I think it's unfair on those who've been through the vaccination, have vaccinated, have made that choice, have done everything that they should do, then to be still faced at risk when they return to work. Because I think although the choice of remaining at home is to be there, there are many places where it's not going to be possible, and where people want to go back to work either because they can't work at home and work. maybe employers need them back in the office. So in the States, we know that already there are changes in New York. The Wall Street banks are leading the way. They require proof of vaccination for employees, either with the Pfizer vaccine before they'll let them back to work in the building. And Delta Airlines, I thought this was really interesting. They have their own their health insurance. And if you're unvaccinated, you're going to face a $200 monthly increases on their health insurance premiums from November, because the risks of them getting COVID and being admitted to hospital and the high cost that that will be to the insurance scheme. So I'm not in any way suggesting that we're going to fine people for not being vaccinated, but we know that the carrot has helped. So that whole thing all along, why are we seeing younger people be vaccinated? Because there is a hope that they'll be able to do more things without restrictions, especially concerts and the likes.
But it's worth saying that we have the second highest rate of vaccination in Europe, and we have it through just getting the public to buy into it without having, without making it mandatory, without incentivizing it in any way, shape or form. Maybe the incentivization or the mandating will get us over the line in terms of 90% plus, but you know, the way we've done it has worked. It's worked very well.
The HSE's position, by the way, just on contact tracing and some of the issues mentioned by Alone a few minutes ago, they're telling us that they have 1,000 contact tracing staff, which I think is higher than the number which had been previously publicly quoted. They say that they get to people within 3 hours on average from positive results for routine tracing, and the complex ones are then referred to public health. Public health deal with schools, but this year they're also going to be supported by tracers. They were dealing with 45 schools a day in May, and they do expect to have many times that number coming into this September. So the official position of the HSE is that they are equipped for all of that. Obviously, we'll see exactly when schools return what sort of demands there will be on them. Margaret says that people tweeting for the vast majority applauding Neffet's close down aren't tweeting for me and many others. The COVID emergency is far from over. Government dissolution of Neffet reeks of political cowardice and a shameful aberration, or I'm not sure what that word is, a shameful dereliction, I suppose, of duty. Is there an election looming? She wonders on the Record NT. Someone else also wonders, whatever happens to the app? The UK, you know, had the pingdemic, but at least they knew that their contact tracing app was working. You don't ever hear of anybody getting pinged through the Irish app anymore, which is an interesting point. Alona Duffy and Hugh O'Connell still with me in studio. The other thing which is talked about aplenty in today's Sunday papers after COVID is, of course, the ongoing situation in Afghanistan. It was this time last week that the government was contemplating whether to send people onto the ground to try and help with the evacuation of Irish citizens. We know that they did. They perhaps could have done it a couple of days earlier. Already, maybe some recriminations about whether Ireland should have put more boots on the ground more quickly.
Yeah, Maeve Sheehan has a really good kind of piece in the Sunday Independent today, just going through the kind of 48 hours in Kabul and going over that decision not to deploy them more quickly. And I mean, I think Simon Coveney has spoken about this subsequent, that like the risk assessment at the time was it wouldn't be safe to send them into that situation. And in particular, I think Maeve points to the fact that they were ready to go at a certain point last weekend, I think, but that they were advised by US and EU military intelligence not to deploy because the airports of Kabul and Ramstein, which is the US military airbase in Germany, were overwhelmed. Ramstein had acted as a logistical hub for processing flights out of Afghanistan. So all flights were stalled. The team didn't deploy. Deployed, obviously, earlier this week. Spent 48 hours in Kabul and got a number of Irish citizens or Afghan citizens with Irish residency out of the country, but have left some 60 behind. And now the question is, well, how do we get them out? And I think probably it's going to involve some sort of land border crossing and then getting them that way. But it's a really hairy situation. I mean, Maeve's piece goes into fascinating detail about the operation. And you know, about the fact, and we knew this already, obviously, that you know, one of the bombs went off while people were waiting to take off.
Yeah, and some of the Irish. The advice that also came from European and American allies just when Ireland was contemplating maybe sending out the Ranger Wing or some diplomats, and they were then told, like, do not deploy.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I mean, it's a really fascinating insight. I encourage everyone to read it. Of course, I would say that working for the Sunday Independent, but it's a really fascinating insight into what happened in Afghanistan. And the decisions that had to be taken. They're certainly not easy decisions. I mean, you know, Simon Coveney probably come under a degree of criticism for not deploying sooner, and certainly those are the questions that he's faced. But these are not easy decisions to make, and you're getting advice and intelligence from the ground, from your military advisors and from your intelligence advisors, and they're telling you not to deploy. It's very difficult to go against that.
Yeah, because you'd be knowingly, I mean, you always are knowingly sending people, you know, into the gap of danger, but then doing so contrary to advice would also be a different thing altogether. I suppose there's also two ways of looking at it, which is that at the time that the Army Rangers and the diplomats were deployed, there was only thought to be somewhere in the region of 30 to 40 Irish citizens that were, you know, needed to be extracted. They got 30 to 40 people out. Mm. They just didn't realize that there'd be another 60 or and then 50
yeah,
more Afghans.
Yeah, that's an issue as defined. Well. I mean, it was such an evolving situation. I think it was an evolving situation for every country that they were kind of discovering slowly that there was more and more people who had a right to residency or were indeed Irish citizens or citizens of the country they were trying to get to, who came forward in those chaotic few days. And it's a difficulty, I suppose, they couldn't have countenanced at the beginning, but obviously came to the fore as the deadline, the US set deadline of August 31st came into effect, and it was clear that a lot of these heavy military operations, the Brits and the US were going to get out of there. You had this scramble, and obviously you had the awful suicide bombing attack as well. Which
had been warned about.
Which
as
had been
well,
warned about.
Know, yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, anyone who saw the footage
only vindicates the advice that they did need to get out.
I mean, anyone who saw the footage, I mean, it's been played on the news channels all week. It was just absolute chaos outside Kabul Airport. And the way the Kabul Airport was structured in such a way that there was quite narrow roads leading up to it because of they needed to, because when Kabul Airport was operating as a kind of a normal airport, or as normal as it could be, they were trying to avoid suicide bomb attacks all the time, or people driving up in car bombs. So it was a very sort of narrow entrance into Kabul Airport and narrow approaches into Kabul Airport. And that has created difficulties when you have these huge throngs of people trying to get out of the country.
As I said, Alona, there's a lot written in today's papers about Afghanistan. Anything that jumped out for you?
I suppose just the Sunday Times piece is kind of nice, simple, going through it all. Charlie Faulkner, you know, what's going to happen to the Afghans now the Taliban's are charged, and just everything. I think when we see how their life is going to completely change, you know, sports aren't allowed, that they're going, you know, people having to hide their phones, get rid of everything that's social media, just that might show them as having led what we count as normal lives. They now have to hide all of that. The whole issue has been well documented with regards to women, education, their freedom. I mean, it's just horrific to see. One of the things I saw last night, actually, on Twitter, was a comparison photograph of three women in Afghanistan in 1974 and three women now. And the three women back in 1974 were there in miniskirts, normal
Western type
clothing, very Western dressed. And three now in the full hijab.
One of the pieces that caught, two pieces in the Sunday Times, actually, Oliver Shah has a piece on the massive amounts of money that the United States poured into Afghanistan over the last 20 years. And it has one example, and this is from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, an independent agency created by the US Congress to monitor use of American taxpayers' money. And one example was that in 2008, the US Department of Defense spent over half a billion dollars, equipping the Afghan Air Force with these military transport planes. The US Air Force had stopped using these 30 years previously, and they couldn't get the parts for these planes anymore. So these planes, when they gave them to the Afghans, were completely useless and kept breaking down, and then were basically on the tarmac for years before they were sold for scrap at, I think, $40,000 a pop.
We thought the disposal of our government jet was bad.
Indeed. And then Josh Glancy has a piece on just the kind of political ramifications for Joe Biden. This is a huge moment for him. He's 8 months into his presidency, and already, you know, the comparisons with what happened in Vietnam obviously are kind of apparent, but, you know, a lot of people are talking about it as sort of this sort of diplomatic crisis that he'll never get out from under, in the same way that Jimmy Carter had massive problems once the with Iran when the hostages in the US embassy in Tehran in the late 1970s, and, you know, the ignominy of them being released minutes after Ronald Reagan was sworn in 1981, it was a stain on Carter's legacy.
But and that
this
was
might
a stain.
Turn out to be a massive problem for Biden going forward.
That was embarrassing enough, but it didn't involve nearly the same number of bodies that are now going to be involved with people who have been American collaborators and contractors who are now left behind, and who knows what. I've seen it even reported inside the last half hour, a Taliban spokesperson saying that women will still be allowed to attend schools and universities, but in accordance with Islamic teaching, they'll have to be put in their own classrooms. They can't be taught at the same pace or alongside men for whatever reason that is. Before we go, just on a very perhaps clumsy gear change, There's a fascinating story on page 6 of the Business Post. It's also mentioned in the Sunday Times today. And Ilona, I know it's a part of the world which is close to your heart because you spent some time up there. Tourism Ireland is under siege, if you like, over the naming of Derry. Explain.
So in their promotional kind of stuff that they have for Derry or Londonderry, they have used Londonderry as a name, that being the official name for the city. But there have been numerous complaints, and I suppose, look, if this is something throughout the era of all the troubles in the north, Londonderry versus Derry, and we know that very much the adding of the Londonderry was rubbing salt into a sore for many people over many years, and it just shows it's still there. There's huge unease and unhappiness. So what have they decided? They decided to use neither name and just call it the Walled City. Yeah. So I don't think that's going to work, because I think if you're trying to promote it, it's going to have the word Derry in it, be it with or without London.
Well, this apparently arose because they ran an Instagram poll, something to do with Shane Seamus Heaney, and they did a sort of a Q&A thing. They asked what county was Seamus Heaney from, and the option given was Londonderry, and the complaints that it was in response to Seamus Heaney, of all people, that they'd use Londonderry is clumsy at best.
It's an interminable debate, and it's going to continue. I think you were making the point outside earlier, Gavin, that the BBC got it right. Radio Foyle, just call it Foyle, dodge the whole thing.
Maybe the Walled City could work if they want to really sort of clamber on that Game of Thrones halo effect that Northern Ireland got. We'll leave it there. Hugh O'Connell and Ilona Duffy, thank you both very much for joining me in studio this morning.
On the Record with Gavin Riley
on News Talk